I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Our guest today is Suzanne Asha Stone. She's the executive director of the International Wildlife Coexistence Network. We're talking about their Wood River Wolf Project, Peter. We've talked about wolves a few times on our show over the years. It's a really important issue. It comes up politically all the time, what to do with wolves and wildlife in Idaho.
Yeah, and recently it's on the federal level with the Pet and Livestock Protection Act that they want to delist gray wolves across the United States. And I think this is going to be a very important conversation because we're looking at and we'll be talking about a different approach to how wolves and livestock and humans can coexist. You know, I think it's going to be a very important conversation that we have today.
Right. And I'm looking forward to it. First, though, Peter, I bet you've got some nature in the news.
Yeah, Leif. You know, Houston is sinking. Houston, Texas is sinking. And of all the most populous cities in the United States, it's sinking the fastest. More than 40% of its area is subsiding approximately 5 millimeters per year.
5 millimeters a year.
And there's another smaller section, about 12%, that's actually above 10 millimeters per year.
10 millimeters a year. That's a centimeter or what, half an inch around there?
Yeah.
A year. It's sinking half an inch a year. Okay. Yep. And any guesses as to why?
So we've got a new study out where these researchers looked at the 28 largest cities found across the United States. And not just coastal cities. We're talking about inland cities as well.
Yeah.
And what they found is the most common cause of the sinking is the massive amount of groundwater these cities are pumping out. And, you know, groundwater does create space in the soil.
Well, exactly. It occupies space in the ground. And when you remove it, you're creating a void.
Yep.
And so the ground subsides.
Yes. And cities tend to be heavy.
They do tend to be heavy things,
especially these cities with these massive skyscrapers and such. So that's one of the biggest problems. But in Houston and Dallas and Fort Worth were in the top five as well. So these three cities in Texas are really sinking fast. And they're also feeling that oil and gas extraction is causing the increased sinking as well.
Right. In especially other parts of the country where there's fracking and that sort of stuff and lots of oil production.
Yeah.
Right. It's the same issue, just maybe deeper.
Yep. And there are some cities that it's not necessarily completely the removal of groundwater.
Right.
Chicago and Denver and Portland are really good examples of this. You know, 20,000 years ago, you know, we had this massive sheet of ice over North America, and ice is absolutely very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And the ice would compact the ground underneath it, but create bulges on the sides.
That's right.
And these bulges are slowly sinking, kind of moving back towards more of an equilibrium. And so Chicago and Denver, Portland, they were built on these edges of these ice sheets and glaciers.
Okay, let's come back to a town like Houston. If it's sinking, it's subsiding, the whole city is going down a half inch every year, which doesn't sound like a whole lot, but you can imagine in 10 years, that's, do the math, that's 5 inches?
That's a lot. Yeah.
Okay, so that over time means you're sinking. But what's the problem, I guess?
When you have structures, you've got these buildings, you've got streets, you've got all this infrastructure that's moving.
Right.
And there are some cities that they might have areas that are sinking and other areas that are rising. And so all of a sudden you've got this tilting where you've got these structures and it's being forced to tilt, not just sink.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it wreaks havoc on your infrastructure, right?
And part of this research, too, is to help engineers develop and design buildings that can handle that type of movement better.
Sure. I think it's also, you know, in the bigger picture, I think it's really easy to lose track that humans have an impact on their environment.
Oh,
Shocking idea, right?
And you know what? Today, we're going to have a conversation about humans' impact within the
environment. So if we take a bunch of water out of the ground, there is a consequence to doing that. And maybe we can find engineering solutions around it, but we're going to notice it, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is another reminder that our actions have consequences. Today, we're going to be talking about wolves. Our trivia question is relating to Idaho. How many wolves were reintroduced by humans to Idaho in the mid-1990s? Let's see if anyone out there remembers this number. When we get back from the break, Suzanne Aisha Stone will join us to talk about wolves and so much more. So please stay tuned.
Every day, overnight, and on holidays and weekends, Public Radio and KISU are here for you, covering the news, community events, science, arts, and music. This is what makes Public Radio so important, but it isn't possible without federal funding. Visit KISU's homepage and click on the protectmypublicmedia.org icon for a user-friendly way to contact Congress to make sure Public Radio stays.
Hey, welcome back from the break. Our guest today is Suzanne Aisha Stone. She's the executive director of the International Wildlife Coexistence Network. First off, welcome to the Nature of Idaho.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
I am currently the director of the International Wildlife Coexistence Network, but I also am the founder of the Wood River Wolf Project, which I'm really excited about us talking about that project today. What do? I am a mom, a grandmother now, and I grew up in Idaho, but I was born in Texas. So you guys were talking about Houston before we came on after this break, and I grew up in that area and actually saw one of the very last of the red wolves in the wild in Texas in the late 1970s, and that's what spurred me on to learn more about wolves. So I'm a Texas girl who was as a kid brought back up here to Idaho and got to spend a lot of time roaming around both states.
That's great that you have this connection with wolves. What brought you to Idaho, can I ask?
Parents, of course. So my family moved here when I was not even a teenager yet. And I was moving from that Houston area where there was, you know, a ton of people. There's millions of people there in Houston now. I think why it's thinking is because it's a giant pancake made out of concrete and it was built over a rainforest. So it's kind of like, yeah, well, that's how nature works. But moved here and I'd never seen mountains before. And I fell in love with the mountains here. And as a child, did a lot of camping and hiking and water skiing, skiing with my family, and just, you know, we just didn't have anything like that in Texas. And so it was really easy to fall in love with Idaho.
It is, isn't it? I've been here for 10 years. You've been 20.
20.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Wood River Wolf Project. And let's start from the very beginning. How did this come into existence?
Well, it happened after, of course, the reintroduction of wolves in the mid-1990s. And about 2004, 2005, wolves showed up in the Blaine County area for the first time since they were eradicated from the state in the 1930s. And we were already working with one of the ranchers there, the Lava Lake Institute, Lava Lake Lamb and Livestock, to try some of the non-lethal measures, that things like fencing and flags and lighting and things like that would help better protect sheep, which are the most vulnerable livestock to predators on the landscape. So we had already successfully tried quite a few types of deterrence with them to help protect their sheep. And it was another producer in the valley that pulled up with a couple of 18-wheelers full of over 1,000 sheep, unloaded them right into the same meadow ecosystem where the first pack of wolves were denning with their pups. And it really wasn't so much that the sheep were there that, although, you know, that's like bringing dinner on a plate, right? It's home delivery. But it was the livestock guardian dogs that were so much of the problem, because wolves think that dogs are basically funny looking wolves, and strange wolves, are the biggest threat to their pups. So the dog triggered a reaction in wolves to be highly defensive. They attacked the dogs that came too close to where their den was, and suddenly we had a dead livestock guardian dog and several dead sheep, and the wolves were being slated to be killed because of that conflict that's happening on our public lands on the Sawtooth National Forest. We jumped on the phone with the folks from Lava Lake, Mike Stevenson, who was their ranch manager, and with Rick Williamson, who was our mentor for our project. He was with Wildlife Services and said, what can we do? You know, we're already working with Lava Lake. This other producer's obviously having problems. The wolves are now on the chopping block, and the community came out and said, you know, they had been enjoying seeing wolves. They had their own mini Yellowstone happening, you know, right off the highway. And they asked us, all of them, can you make this work? How do we make this work? And so we set about, you know, putting in things like fladry, which is, it looks like the flags that sometimes are around like used car parking lots.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's strung up.
Like, right? Yeah, it's like flags on a long string. Well, it came from Europe. They, in old times, they would cut up pieces of clothing and put them on this long rope and set up the rope in a giant V shape. And the villagers would go through the forest literally with pots and pans and their spoons and chase the wolves into the wide end of the V. And then the hunters would wait for them in the narrow end and kill the wolves. My mentor my supervisor in college this was one of the things that he saw happening or read about in Europe. He tested it up at the University of Calgary and as a non-lethal tool. And so we were among the very first to try it in a wild setting in North America, actually anywhere in the world, as a non-lethal deterrent. And it worked. It surprised everybody, but it worked. And we thought, okay, well, this is what we use to pen the sheep at night. And then it's really easy to drop it and let the sheep go out during the morning and they graze all day. And it's very easy to move around. So for the rest of the grazing season, another 2 or 3 months, we had the sheep going in at night and there were wolves in the valley. You could hear the wolves howling from where the sheep were. And we had no more losses, no more conflicts. We all got together after that and they said, the ranchers said, well, you got lucky. Can you do it again? And that was 18 years ago. So we're still doing
this. This is that flagging material.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we haven't used fladry in years because we have so many other tools now that are actually easier and better to use. Things like fox lights, which create the same kind of thing where you're creating a barrier where the sheep are. Wolves can see it from a distance. The fox light came to us from an inventor in Australia who was using it to protect his sheep from fox. And it's this brilliant device that turns on, it's solar powered now, and turns on when it gets dark. And it has random colors and random patterns that, you know, goes through the night. So it looks like from a distance, somebody walking around the woods with a flashlight, which is what the wolves are thinking. We think that they think there's humans present with the lights there.
Interesting.
So it's just you've got multiple lights around the sheep and it just randomly flashes. Like you said, someone's just walking around the woods. And I can imagine ranchers can throw that in the back of their backpack and just take it anywhere.
Okay. It's really easy. We're even putting them on the dogs' collars now.
Yeah.
If the livestock guardian dogs get excited, there's things that are being invented, like bark collars, where if they start barking, it lights up. There's others that are using it to create that fox light effect of just coming on randomly. But it's all just to give the wolf a sense that humans are there, that these are not abandoned lives.
So I've got a question. 18 years later, and you're still working on this project, are you still working with the original ranchers, especially the one that said, well, it worked this year. How about next year? How is that partnership going? And what do they feel like now with this non-lethal deterrent?
It is a wonderfully evolving partnership. I remember early on, one of the main ranch operations, the owner was like, you know, by God, I will never, ever use that flattery. And he said the same thing about fox lights. He said the same thing about using multiple livestock guardian dogs, which we found is more effective than just using one or two, because the wolves think that the dogs are strange wolves and they will avoid strange wolves. And especially if it's outside of denning season, they just try to avoid them. It's just less risky for them. And so if you have four or five dogs with a band of sheep, you know, it could be 1,000 to 1,500 sheep or more, then they interpret that that pack already has those sheep. And so we're not going to mess with them. And so they tend to avoid them. But that producer was like, over and over again, I heard hell will freeze over before we try this. And they're trying it and they're doing great with it. So they're, you know, you just have to have patience. It's new stuff. Some of it doesn't look like it should work. It's, you know, the flattery early on, I mean, it was almost comical thinking that a wolf would avoid something like that. But for some reason, they are very triggered by it. It's intimidating to them. So, you know, our job is really just to think like the predator. You know, what is it that the predator is being attracted to, and how do we stop that attractant? How do we create a deterrent there?
And I like what you said. We need to think like the predator. And I would argue that throughout the history of human and wolf contact / conflict, we have failed to think like a wolf. We've got our own perceptions of what wolves should be like. And I think we've been incorrect most of the way.
We have. And one of the most common things that attracts wolves to an area has been happening recently in California. It's made a lot of news. And it's dead livestock. You know, these great big dead livestock pits where the cattle have died because of birthing problems or disease or whatever. And then they pile them up and leave them there. And wolves are scavengers. That's a free meal. And that's a safe free meal. So it's like they've become habituated to coming to these livestock carcass piles. And that's a big attraction for them. They'll come back over and over and over again. They'll come back years later, just hoping that there's going to be something there to reward them. So helping the ranchers understand that if you're not interested in attracting wolves to your property or to where your livestock are, remove the dead livestock as soon as you can, especially if it's a built-up situation where you have, you know, dozens of dead livestock. That's not just for wolves. All predators are attracted that are scavengers as well.
It's one of those things you would think via Yellowstone that we would have learned that lesson or figured it out, right? As soon as I got rid of all the trash pits and such, less bear encounters.
Yeah, it seems obvious until maybe somebody does it.
Right.
I'm curious, with all these different sort of measures, non-lethal measures to keep wolves away from livestock, do you ever see instances where one of the strategies where wolves learn to get accustomed? I'm thinking of maybe you had a lighting sort of pattern or something like that that initially they didn't like. But over enough time, they start realizing, oh, maybe it's not a threat, and they can kind of outsmart the strategy.
Yeah, we anticipated that wolves being, you know, smart, that they would habituate to any of these tools. So we rotate the tools so that they don't get exposed to the same tools over and over again.
Okay.
And that's another problem that I'm seeing in places like California, where the flattery fence line is put up along fence lines. It's not being installed properly, so it's not at the right height to stop them from crossing. And once they cross under something like that, because it's not at the right height, it suddenly they'll lose their fear of it. And then they've kept the stuff up for what looks like a long, long time. And we found the best efficacy with the flattery barriers was somewhere between 60 and 93 days. That's about how much time it's going to buy you. So we only used it in an emergency kind of situation or in between other types of tools so that they don't become habituated to it. Because once they do, you've lost a tool in the toolbox. And, you know, those are precious. We had put the flattery up when we were testing it early on. Idaho was one of the first places, I think the first place that was actually tested out in the field. And we tested around in Clayton, Idaho. There was a pond there that Fish and Game had stocked with a whole bunch of fish smolts. And it was like an open sushi bar for the wolves. They were coming every night and just gorging on these fish, right? So we thought, this is the perfect place to try this stuff. So we put the flattery up around that fish pond, and it went for weeks, right? Where there was just wolf tracks.
All around.
Very frustrated wolf tracks are on the outside. But not one of them penetrated until we had a huge windstorm. And that storm lifted up one side, brought the flag tree up high enough that they weren't scared of it, and they slipped underneath. And that night, you know, back to the sushi bar.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's trial and error with this stuff and figuring out what works, how it works, and why.
Yeah. So in that case, they don't like walking over that barrier. That's the inhibiting part for them.
It is really rare for them to try to jump over it.
That's so interesting.
Because it's moving.
Yeah.
When it's properly installed, it almost looks like a monster with moving arms. Like, you know,
That's really interesting. No thanks.
And there's an easier meal somewhere else. And that's what you want to tell them, is that there's an easier meal somewhere else. And wolves tend to stay focused on wild prey unless there's something that draws them.
Sure.
So in Eastern Oregon, when wolves first hit the ground there, we got calls that they were killing a lamb out near Baker City. And we went out, and like within 150 yards, there was the biggest carcass pile of dead livestock I'd ever seen. And so the wolves came in, they looked at the carcass pile, this old maggoty, rotten stuff. And then they looked at the fresh spring lambs that were sitting on the other side of the fence. And it was just a plain fence. They cross over barbed wire, like they'll jump over it like it's not even there. And they were having a lamb dinner. You know, it's like they make the same choices sometimes we do, right? Then between the two, that's where we go. So just always thinking of what the way that they're going to approach things. And most of their world is through scent. So they have this incredible olfactory system that they can smell this dead livestock from miles and miles away. And it actually drew them from over 10 miles away from out of the Eagle Cap wilderness to come down to investigate what smelled so good down below. And then they bumped into the lambs. So if that carcass pit had not been there, they would never have made their trip down there.
You know, I look at this with the Wood River Wolf Project. You are constantly learning, finding new ways to live and coexist with wolves, ranchers, and livestock. Then you have to turn around and try to educate the ranchers on how to appropriately manage their livestock within wolf territory. They have to learn as well. And I just, it seems like it's a pretty big task on both ends, learning and then teaching. And you're probably going to run into some ranchers initially who want to resist some of these changes. This is a big job you've got.
It is. And some of the most rewarding parts are ranchers who are teaching us, because there are people, Cameron Krebs is one over in Eastern Oregon, who looked at all the things we were doing and went, I can make this better. I can do it better. And he did. So he set up these night corrals that are electric woven wire fencing. He moves them every couple of days. The Forest Service at first was like, we don't like fencing on Forest Service land. He's like, well, let's compromise here. We're going to take a bunch of native speed, put them in the areas where we're night corralling these sheep. And those are the greenest, most beautiful, most biodiverse areas the next spring. So, you know, there's ways we can make this stuff work if we want to. The problem is that, you know, a lot of people are still under this, position that somehow wolves are bad. And therefore, you know, trying to tolerate having them on the landscape means we're giving in and we're trying to support something that shouldn't be there. And don't realize that wolves are their best ally for things like culling disease. Guess what? We've got chronic wasting disease. We've got all kinds of stuff that are threatening our elk and deer and moose populations and cattle as well. And wolves they're probably one of the best at culling that disease from the herds because of how they go about preying on these animals. They're looking for vulnerability. That's why they're so good at detecting disease and pulling it out. And their olfactory system, they can smell that diseased animal running through a herd of hundreds of elk. They can detect almost instantaneously which animals are sick. And then they hone in on those animals. So, you know, they're a gift in terms of nature protecting itself. And we just don't understand enough about them to realize what a great value that they are on the landscape.
So this is one project within your broader, you know, International Wildlife Coexistence Network. Are there other projects going on around the world? It's in the title international. So what other kinds of things are happening around the world?
Yeah, so when we published our first paper on the Wood River Wolf Project, it stunned people that the scientific literature at the time was that you couldn't use these tools and methods across a large landscape. It was called infeasible, impossible, even by the top wolf scientists in the world, that it couldn't be done. And so when we, you know, published our paper after 7 years of showing that we have 20 to 25,000 sheep in our project area, and we're losing less than 5 sheep a year to wolves, and we have constant presence of wolves because we're using these methods. When we compare it to the neighbors where in other counties, you know, they're losing hundreds of sheep, killing now dozens and dozens of wolves, packs over time, and it's far more expensive doing that as well. So it was like an aha moment, I think, for all of us, that maybe this isn't just that it works with wolves, maybe it works with bears, maybe it works with mountain lions, with dingo in Australia, with lions in Africa. And people around the world were trying these approaches in different ways, but they had no way of like connecting with others who were doing the same thing. So we found each other. And that's what the International Wildlife Coexistence Network is all of these practitioners around the world that are finding ways to coexist and to stay in biodiversity in their area to help rewild their ecosystems, and comparing notes and helping share that knowledge and those studies with each other so that we can best support each other. Yeah, it's incredible. I love it. And we might be working, you know, in the morning on beaver in the UK, and in the, you know, afternoon we might be talking about dingo and koala in Australia, and it's just all interwoven.
And it all comes back to Blaine County.
Blaine
County for being willing to try something new.
Yeah. Right.
Well, so, and with the biodiversity around the world today, you know, we have to find a different way. It is about not only preserving wildlife, but it's about preserving humanity as well. We cannot survive without strong ecosystems and good biodiversity around the world. We just can't. Those ecosystems collapse and it takes our food resources with it. It will have a devastating impact on humanity if we continue down this path. So we have to find a better way. And this is actually a way that's positive. It's a win for everybody, and it's doable. So it just makes the most sense.
Yeah, it's great to hear that there are solutions that work and that there are non-lethal choices to be made, right? And so that wolves can be part of our world. I think that's really, really valuable. We started with a trivia question of how many wolves were reintroduced by humans in Idaho in the mid-90s. Can you help us with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I released a few of them. But there were, in total, there were 35 that were released between 1995 and 1996.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Suzanne, for joining us today. I think this is a very important conversation, not just about wolves, about our interactions within our world ecosystem and community. And for everyone who wants to learn more about the Wood River Wolf Project and the International Wildlife Coexistence Network, please go to wildlifecoexistence.org. And spend your time there. Again, thank you so much, Suzanne.
Yeah, thank you. It really comes down to just working with nature instead of against her. So we really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you guys. And thanks for your program. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU FM. Shows are produced at KISU Studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University, with editing and production by Mackenzie Young. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at kisu.org, from Spotify or other select podcast services, or from KISU's mobile app. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noid-kisu@isu.edu.